"Fill me, Nelly," he said. "How old are you pair, anyway? You look like children."
"I'm 19, said Julian. "And my friend here is 18.
He pulled all his money out of his pocket and nodded at me to do the same, so the man could see that we could pay for what we ordered.
"Why do you ask?"
"Just making conversation," he said, reaching for one of the taps.
"You realise that I might have to charge lads your age a little more than usual. I call it the youth tax."
"Whatever you think is fair," said Julian.
"Now fuck off," said the barman.
But he said it more from amusement than annoyance.
A few minutes later, he brought over the drinks, set them down before us, and returned to his station.
"What time is it now?" asked Julian, and I nodded towards the clock on the wall.
"Almost 6, I said.
"Grand job. How do I look?"
"You look like a Greek god sent down by the immortal Zeus from Mount Olympus to taunt the rest of us inferior beings with your astonishing beauty," I said, which somehow in translation came out as,
"You look fine. Why?"
"No reason,"
he said.
"Just checking." "You're a good man, Cyril,"
he added, reaching over and resting his hand on top of mine for a moment. And a current of electricity ran through me, as exhilarating as I imagined it would feel were he to lean forward and press his lips against my own. He looked into my eyes and held them briefly before frowning a little. Perhaps he could sense an emotion that even he was not yet mature enough to understand.
"You are too, Julian," I began.
And perhaps in the heat of the moment, I might have been ready to become more rapturous in my praise and to give myself away entirely, but before I could say another word, the door to the pub swung open, and I looked across as 2 girls entered, one of whom, to my surprise, seemed familiar to me. They glanced around nervously, for they were the only women in the place, before catching sight of me and Julian, at which point the girl in front smiled and strode towards us.
"Bridget!"
said Julian, turning now, taking his hand from mine quickly and breaking into a wide smile.
"There you are! I knew you'd come."
"You knew nothing of the sort," she said, winking at him. "I bet you probably said a few novenas to make your wishes come true, though."
Of course, I realized then it was the waitress from the doll tea room dressed to the nines in a tight-fitting red dress that drew attention to her breasts, her face a clown's visage of makeup. Next to her was another girl, perhaps a year younger, shorter, no makeup, the very definition of mousy, with mud-brown hair, beer-bottle glasses, and an expression that suggested she had recently eaten something that didn't agree with her. The Cyril to Bridget's Julian, so to speak. My heart sank as I realized that this was exactly why she was here, and I turned to stare at Julian, who at least felt enough shame to avoid my eye.
"What'll you have, ladies?"
he asked, clapping his hands together as they sat down.
"Are these seats clean?"
asked the second girl, taking a handkerchief from the sleeve of her blouse and wiping it against the fabric. "The arses of some of the best men and women in Dublin have sat in them," he told her. "Sit yourself down there, sweetheart, and if you catch any diseases, I promise to pay the vet bill myself."
"Charming," she said. "You're a real gentleman."
"We'll have 2 snowballs," said Bridget. "This is my pal, Mary Margaret."
"You remember Cyril, don't you?"
"How could I forget him?
Cyril the squirrel."
"Cyril the squirrel,"
repeated Julian, bursting out laughing at her hilarious joke.
"You have an angelic look about you. Did anyone ever tell you that?"
she asked, leaning forward and examining my face.
"He looks as if he's never been kissed,"
she added to Julian. And I felt like a specimen under a microscope the 2 doctors were studying closely.
"I'll just have an orange juice," said Mary Margaret, raising her voice a little.
2 snowballs," repeated Bridget.
2 snowballs,"
shouted Julian to the barman, pointing at her glasses, which were perilously close to empty.
"And 2 more pints of plain?"
"I'll be on my year," said Mary Margaret. "And I have to be up for 6 o'clock mass in the morning. Father Dwyer is on tomorrow, and he says a lovely mass."
Sure you haven't had a drop yet, said Bridget. One is hardly going to tip you over the edge into alcoholism.
One, she insisted. But one is all I'll have. I'm not a drinker, Bridget, as you know.
How are you, Mary Margaret? Said Julian, winking at her and nodding towards me. This is me pal Cyril.
You already said that. Do you think I have the memory of a goldfish?
What do you think?
What do you think of what?
Of Cyril, Cyril the squirrel.
What am I supposed to think of him? She asked,
looking me up and down like I was the creature from the Black Lagoon, and she'd had the bad luck of standing close to the water while I crawled on shore.
A queer fella in a public toilet asked me could he give me a blowy earlier.
My mouth fell open in horror, Mary Margaret's in disbelief, and Bridget's in delight.
That never happened, I said, and my vocal cords chose that unfortunate moment to crack a little. He's making it up.
This isn't my standard of conversation at all, said Mary Margaret, turning to Bridget.
The snowballs arrived at the same moment, and she took a sniff of hers before swallowing almost all of it in one go without showing any particular reaction.
Are these going to be vulgar boys? Because I don't care for vulgar boys, as you know. I'll have another one of these if they're gone.
Two more snowballs, roared Julian.
In the silence that followed, Mary Margaret turned to look at me again, and if anything, she seemed even less impressed by me now than she had before, which was something that I hadn't thought possible.
Cecil, is it?
She asked.
Cyril, I said. Cyril what?
Cyril Avery.
Well, she said with a little sniff, it's not the worst name I've ever heard.
Thank you.
I only came because Bridget asked me to. I didn't know that we were making up a foursome.
Neither did I said.
That's not my standard at all, she said.
How was the tea room today? Asked Julian.
Did President Eisenhower stop by to say hello?
Mr. Eisenhower is the American president, said Mary Margaret,
turning to him contemptuously.
Our president is Mr. O'Kelly. You can't be that ignorant, surely.
I was making a joke, Mary Margaret, said Julian, rolling his eyes. Have you ever heard of one of those?
I don't care for jokes, she replied.
I've never even heard of President Eisenhower, said Bridget with a shrug.
Eisenhower, I said.
Eisenhower,
she repeated.
That's it, I said. Do you work in the tea room too, Mary Margaret? Asked Julian.
I do not, she said,
insulted by the very suggestion, despite the fact that her friend was sitting next to her.
I'm a junior cash assistant in the foreign exchange desk at the Bank of Ireland College Green.
You are not, said Julian.
I am,
she said.
You are not. You're making it up.
Why would I do such a thing?
She asked.
Right then. Say something in Norwegian.
Mary Margaret stared at him, as if she didn't quite understand what he was getting at before turning to Bridget, who leaned forward and slapped Julian's forearm playfully, leaving her hand there afterwards, which made me want to pick up a stray knife from the next table and cut it off.
Don't mind him, said Bridget, full of fun. He thinks he's the bee's knees.
And the cat's pyjamas, said Julian with a wink. You're the cat's something.
That doesn't even mean anything, I said quietly.
The Norwegians use Norwegian kroner,
announced Mary Margaret, pulling a face and looking away.
I don't care for it very much, if I'm honest. When you count it out, it leaves an ink stain in your hands, and that's not my standard at all. I prefer international currency that leaves no residue. Australian banknotes are very clean, as are those of their nearest neighbours, the New Zealanders.
Christ alive, you're a fascinating creature, said Julian.
And by now we'd finished another round, and more had just arrived. On my orders, after Julian had looked at the near-empty glasses and given me a nudge.
Actually, that's a common misconception, I said. New Zealand isn't Australia's nearest neighbour at all.
Of course it is, said Mary Margaret. Don't be ridiculous.
I'm not being ridiculous. Papua New Guinea is closer. We studied it in geography class.
There's no such place.
Well, I said, uncertain how I could go about proving it. There is.
Stop flirting with the poor girl, Cyril, said Julian.
She'll be only like a bear in a beehive if you keep this dirty talk up.
I work on the foreign exchange desk at the Bank of Ireland College Green, she repeated, in case we had forgotten her telling us this a few minutes before. I think I know a little more about world geography than you.
Not if you've never heard of Papua New Guinea, I muttered, burying myself in my pint.
I bought a new pair of nylons, said Bridget, apropos of nothing. I'm debuting them tonight. What do you think?
And she swung around to the left of the stool so her legs could stretch out before us. I had little to compare them against, but I could tell that they were impressive enough if you liked that sort of thing. From the top of her head to the soles of her feet, Bridget was a stunner, and there was no point denying it. All I had to do was look at Julian to see how infatuated he was. I recognized the expression on his face only too well, for I wore it myself most of the time.
"They're absolutely gorgeous," said Julian, winking at her. "But I bet I could talk you out of them."
"Cheek,"
she said, snapping his arm again and laughing before turning her attention back to me.
"How are you anyway, Cyril?"
she asked.
"Do you have any news for me?"
"Not too much," I said. "I got a highly regarded for my essay on Pope Benedict XV and his efforts to pursue a peace settlement during the First World War."
"And you're only telling me now?"
said Bridget.
"You never asked," I said.
"Jesus, there's a pair of them in it,"
said Julian, looking back and forth between Mary Margaret and myself.
"Is it just me or does this place smell?" asked Mary Margaret, pulling a face.
"It might just be you," said Julian. "Have you had a bath this week?"
"I meant, is it just me who thinks that there's a smell?" she asked, snarling at him. "It does smell a bit like piss," said Bridget. "Bridget," said Mary Margaret, scandalized.
"That's because we're sitting atop of the stairs," said Julian.
"And the men's jacks are down there.
All you need to do, Mary Magdalene, is turn your head around that corner and you'll be able to see all the old lads with their tings out."
"It's Mary Margaret," said Mary Margaret, "not Mary Magdalene."
"My mistake."
"And I'd rather you didn't talk about tings, if you please."
"Nothing wrong with tings," said Julian.
"None of us would be here without them. I'd be lost without my ting. It's my best friend after Cyril here, although I leave you to figure out which one I have more fun with."
I smiled, the drink beginning to affect me a little, considering it quite a compliment to be higher ranked in his estimation than his penis.
"Bridget,"
said Mary Margaret, turning to her friend,
"I don't care for this type of dirty talk. It isn't my standard." "Boys are obsessed with their things," said Bridget, shaking her head. "It's all they ever talk about."
"Not true," said Julian. "Only last week I had a conversation with a lad from my mathematics class about quadratic equations. Although now that I think of it, we were taking a piss side by side at the time, and I have to admit I took a quick look at his to see how I measured up."
"Who was it?" I asked, feeling a stirring in my crotch at the thought of it.
"Peter Trefontaine."
"And how was it?"
"Small," said Julian. "And a curve to the left a little in a weird way."
"Would you please stop?" asked Mary Margaret. "I have to be up for mass in the morning."
"With Father Dwyer, yes, you mentioned. I bet he's got a tiny thing."
"Bridget, I will leave if this boy continues to..." "Stop it, Julian," said Bridget. "You're embarrassing Mary Margaret." "I'm not embarrassed," she insisted, her face turning puce now. "I'm repulsed." "There's a difference."
"No more talk of things, so," said Julian, taking a long drink from his pint.
"Although it might interest you to know that many years ago, when Cyril here and I were only children, he asked whether he could see my ting."
"I did not," I cried, horrified. "He asked me."
"There's no shame in it, Cyril," he said, smiling. "It was just youthful high jinks, that's all. It's not like you're a queer or anything.
I did not ask to see his thing, I repeated, and Bridget spat a little of her snowball on the table as she started laughing. If this is the sort of conversation we're going to have, said Mary Margaret. I didn't, I insisted.
In fairness, I have a very nice thing, said Julian.
Cyril will tell you.
How would I know?
I said, blushing furiously.
Because we share a room? He replied. Don't pretend you haven't looked. I've looked at yours. You have quite a nice one yourself, although it's not as big as mine. But it's bigger than Peter Trefontaine's, even when you don't have a stiffy, which, let's face it, isn't very often. You'll be the first to admit that, wouldn't you, Cyril?
Oh, my stars, said Mary Margaret, looking as if she was about to faint. Bridget, I want to go home.
Actually, Mary Margaret, you're the only one around this table who hasn't seen my thing, said Julian. Which, I suppose, makes you the odd one out.
There was silence as we all took in what he had said. I felt my stomach slowly dip, and realized that for all our escapes from Belvedere College together, sometimes Julian escaped alone, or, worse by far, escaped with someone who was his sexual peer and with whom he could go in search of girls. The notion that he had a life, outside our friendship, was deeply hurtful to me. And the realization, as it slowly dawned, that Bridget had seen his thing, whether this meant she had simply touched it, or looked at it, or given him a blowy, or gone all the way with him, was almost too much for me to bear. But the first time since I was a child, I felt like a child.
"You've an awful melt on you,"
said Bridget, half embarrassed, half aroused by his words.
"Well, you've a great one on you,"
he replied, leaning forward and smiling. And before any of us knew it was happening, they were kissing. I glanced down at my drink, trembling a little before lifting it to my lips and finishing it off in one go, then stared around the room as if nothing at all was happening.
"Isn't the ceiling work very intricate?" I asked, looking up so I didn't have to watch the pair of them pawing away at each other.
"My mother is in the Legion of Mary," declared Mary Margaret. "I don't know what she'd say to this kind of carry-on."
"Relax,"
said Julian, as they separated and he sat back with a contented look on his face. A look that said, "I'm young, I'm good-looking, I like girls and they like me. There is no end to the amount of fun I'm going to have once I leave the shackles of a secondary education behind me."
"Do you like the tea room, Bridget?" I asked, desperate to change the subject.
"What?"
she said, looking at me in bewilderment. She seemed unsettled by the passionate kiss, and had a look on her face that suggested she wanted nothing more than for me and Mary Margaret to leave her and Julian alone, so they could go wherever they had gone in the past to do whatever they had done.
"What tea room?"
"The tea room you work in," I said. "What other tea room would I be talking about? The tea room in Dáil Éireann."
"All right," she said. "Sure, we're splitting our sides all day, Cyril," with laughter. "Ah, no. I'm only teasing you. It's all right. The TDs are a smarmy bunch, and most of them can't resist slapping your arse when you walk past them. But they tip well, because they know that if they don't, Mrs. Goggin will sit them at a rotten table the next day, and they'll never get to ingratiate themselves with the minister."
"Was she the one who had the Gordos and the doll that day?" asked Julian.
"It was, yeah."
"Christ, she was some piece of material."
"Ah, no," said Bridget, shaking her head. "Mrs. Goggin is one of the good ones. She demands a lot from her staff, but works harder than any of us at the same time. And she never asks anyone to do anything that she won't do herself. She has no airs and graces, and like some in that building. No, I won't hear a word is said against her."
"Fair enough," said Julian, chastised. "To Mrs. Goggin," he said, raising his pint.
"To Mrs. Goggin,"
said Bridget, raising hers too. And what choice did Mary Margaret and I have but to join in?
"Do you have a Mrs. Goggin in the Bank of Ireland?" asked Julian.
"No, we have a Mr. Fellows."
"And do you like him?"
"It's not my place to have an opinion on my superiors."
Is she always as cheerful? Asked Julian of Bridget.
The smell of piss is getting worse in here,
she said in reply.
Should we sit somewhere else, do you think?
We looked around, but the palace had grown busy with the work crowd, and we were lucky to have a seat at all.
There's nowhere else, said Julian,
yawning a little as he made way into his next pint.
Christ, we're lucky enough to have kept this table for so long.
The regulars would have every right to tip us off it.
Do you mind?
Said Mary Margaret.
Do you mind what?
Not taking the name of the Lord our God in vain.
I don't mind the slightest. Why, did you drop into your desk on the Foreign Exchange at the Bank of Ireland College Green after his lunch to tell you that he doesn't like us?
Have you not read the Ten Commandments? She asked.
No, but I've seen the film.
Bridget, this is beyond the beyonce. Are we to sit here all evening and listen to this gibberish?
For what it's worth, I said, feeling the room begin to spin a little.
The capital of Papua New Guinea is Port Moresby.
What?
Said Mary Margaret, looking at me as if I was an imbecile before turning to Julian.
Is this fella soft in the head or what?
She asked. Do you suppose Yul Brynner has a baldy head, or does he shave it for the films? He said in reply.
Bridget, he's only having a laugh, Mary Margaret, said Bridget. Don't mind him. I don't like jokes about Yul Brynner, said Mary Margaret. Not when he gave such an impassioned performance as the Pharaoh Ramesses. I prefer that we show him a little more respect, if you don't mind.
Is he a friend of yours, then? Asked Julian. You have friends in high places all the same. God, Yul Brynner, Mr. Fellows.
The Lord give it and the Lord take it away, said Mary Margaret, which didn't seem to me to have any bearing on what we'd just been talking about.
But I'm the Lord, said Julian.
What?
Asked Mary Margaret, confused now.
I said I'm the Lord. I've been sent down by my father, who's also the Lord, to set people on the right path. What we want, the daddy and me, is for everyone to take their clothes off and just leap on each other like wild dogs in heat. Adam and Eve were naked, as you'll know if you've read the book of the beginnings of it all, chapter 1, verse 1. And lo, there was a man, and lo, there was a woman, and neither of them had a stitch on, and lo, the woman did lie down, and lo, the man did all kinds of mad stuff with the woman, her big tits, and was gagging for it.
That's not in the Bible,
insisted Mary Margaret, leaning over the table, her hands clenching into fists as she prepared to rip Julian's throat from his neck.
Well, maybe not the bit about the big tits, but the rest of it is spot on, I think.
Squirrel, she said, appealing to me. Are you really friends with this person? Is he leading you astray?
It's Cyril, I barked.
Sorry, what are we talking about?
Asked Bridget,
on whom the snowballs were beginning to have an effect.
I was off in a word of my own. I was thinking about Cary Grant. It's just me, or is Cary Grant the most handsome man alive?
The present company accepted, said Julian. Only a blind man could deny Cyril the Squirrel's charms. But why are the subject of ridiculously handsome man? Has anyone seen who's over there at the bar?
We all turned our heads to look, and my eyes ran along the 6 or 7 statues seated on their stools, staring at their reflections in the mirror behind the bar.
Who?
Asked Bridget, reaching forward and grabbing Julian's hand.
Who is it? I heard Bing Crosby is over for a golf championship. Is it him?
Look over there towards the end, said Julian, nodding in the direction of a portly man with a jowly face and dark hair who was seated on the last stool before the stained glass division.
You don't recognize him, no?
He looks like Father Dwyer, said Mary Margaret. A man like that wouldn't be caught dead in a place like this. He reminds me a bit of my Uncle Dermot, said Bridget. But he died 2 years ago, so it can't be him either.
It's Brandon Behan, said Julian, sounding amazed that we didn't recognize him.
Who?
Asked Bridget.
Brandon Behan, he repeated.
The writer? I asked. The first time I had spoken in a long time, and Julian turned to me with an expression that suggested he'd forgotten I was even there.
Of course the writer, he said. Who else could I mean?
Brendan Behan the milkman.
Is he the man who wrote that Borstal Boy thing?
Asked Mary Margaret.
And the queer fellow, said Julian. A great Dubliner.
Is he not a terrible drunk? She asked.
Says the girl in her fourth snowball.
Father Dwyer said that was an awful play. And the book he wrote about the prison, Daddy wouldn't have it in the house.
Mr. Bean! Mr. Bean! Cried Julian, turning around and waving his arms in the air. And sure enough, the man turned around and looked at us, a disdainful expression dissolving into a cheerful one, perhaps on account of our youth.
Anshaw, he said. Do I know you?
No, but we know you, said Julian.
My pal and I here are Belvedere boys, and we value the written word even if the Jesuits don't. Would you join us at all? I consider it an honour to buy a pint. Cyril, buy Mr. Bean a pint.
Salt,
said Bean, shuffling off his seat and walking over, taking a smaller stool from a nearby table to join our group and settling in between Mary, Margaret and myself, leaving Julian and Bridget next to each other. The moment he sat down, he turned to Mary Margaret and looked into her eyes before slowly glancing down to focus on her breasts.
A fine pair,
he said, looking around the table as a fresh round arrived, and Julian took the money from my hand before handing it to the barman.
Small, but not excessively so. Just right for the palm of a man's hand. I've always believed there's a direct correlation between the size of a man's hand, the circumference of his wife's tits, and the happiness of their marriage.
Sense of life,
said Mary Margaret, looking as if she was about to faint.
I read your book, Mr. Bean,
said Julian before she could hit him.
Please,
said Bean, raising a hand while he smiled beatifically at us all.
No formalities, please. Call me Mr. Bean.
Mr. Bean, it is so,
said Julian, laughing a little.
And why did you read us? Did you have nothing better to do with your time? How old are you, anyway?
15, said Julian.
15?
Asked Bridget, feigning shock.
You tell me you were 19.
I am 19,
said Julian cheerfully.
Well, I was 15, said Bean. I was so busy pulling me Mickey to be worrying about reading books. Fair play to you now, young fella.
This is not my standard,
said Mary Margaret, making good headway through her fifth snowball and being so appalled by the turn the conversation had taken that she had little choice but to water another.
My father tried to get it banned, continued Julian. He hates anything to do with republicanism, so I had to see what all the fuss was about.
Who's your father?
Max Woodbead.
The solicitor.
That's the one.
Oh, got his ear shot off by the IRA.
Yes, nodded Julian.
Jesus,
said Bean, shaking his head and laughing as he lifted the pint that Mary Margaret had ordered and drank a good quarter of it without batting an eyelid.
You must have a few quid, so we'll keep you on call here all night.
Can I ask you a question, Mr. Bean?
Asked Bridget, leaning forward with a look on her face that suggested she was either going to ask where he got his ideas or whether he wrote by hand or on a typewriter.
If it's will you marry me, the answer's no. But if it's will I take you the giddle for a quick ride, then it's yes,
said Bean.
And there was a long silence before he started laughing and took another mouthful of his Guinness.
I'm only pulling your leg, darling. Let's have a look at your legs anyway. Swing them out there. Come on all the way. Let the dog see the rabbit. Jesus, they're not bad all the same. The two of them, which always helps. And they go up a fair way.
They meet in the middle too,
said Bridget. A line that made me, Julian, and Mary Margaret sit back in a mixture of admiration and disbelief. Julian looked as if he was about to rise off the seat and lost the very idea.
Is this your fella? It is,
Bean asked, nodding at Julian.
I don't know yet,
said Bridget, shooting Julian a sidelong glance.
I haven't made up me mind yet.
I'm buffering her up, said Julian. I'm giving her the old would-be charm.
She'll be getting the old Bean charm if you're not careful. All about you, young fella?
He asked, turning to me.
You look like you'd rather be anywhere else but here right now.
Not at all,
I said, not wanting to let Julian down. I'm having a great time.
You're not. I am. I am what?
I am Mr. Bean, I said, uncertain what he meant.
I can see right through you,
he said, leaning forward and looking me directly in the eyes.
You're like a wall of glass. I can see right into the depths of your soul, and it is a dark cave filled with indecent thoughts and immoral fantasies. Good man yourself.
A long silence followed, during which everyone at the table, with the exception of Bean himself, felt awkward.
Bridget,
said Mary Margaret finally, breaking the silence but slurring her words,
I think it's time I went home. I don't want to stay here any longer.
Have another snowball, said Bridget, who was getting as drunk as any of us, and she waved her finger over the table without even looking around, and, to my astonishment, within about 2 minutes, a fresh round arrived.
Was everything you said in your book true?
Asked Julian. In Borstal Boy, I mean.
Christ, I hope not,
said Bean, shaking his head as he lifted his next pint.
A book would be terrible boring if everything in it was true, don't you think? Especially an autobiography. I can't remember half of it anyway, so I presume I've slandered a few people along the way. Was that why your daddy wanted to have a band?
He doesn't approve of your past.
Do you have a sensational past, Mr. Bean?
Asked Bridget.
I have a few of them. Which part is it that he didn't like?
When you tried to blow up the Liverpool docks, said Julian. The bit that landed you in Borstal in the first place.
Your daddy isn't a sympathiser, then.
He wants the Brits to come back in and take control, said Julian. He's born and bred in Dublin, but he's ashamed of the fact.
Oh, sure, it takes all sorts to make a world.
What about you, young fella?
He asked, turning his attention to me. I don't care, I said. I have no interest in politics. Tell him who your mother is, said Julian, nudging me in the arm. I don't know who my mother is, I replied.
How can you not know who your mother is?
Asked Bean.
He's adopted,
said Julian.
And you don't know who your mother is?
He asked. No, I said.
Then why did he...
Tell him who your adoptive mother is, said Julian. And I looked down at the table, focusing on a stain that I was trying to scrub clean with my thumb. Maud Avery, I said quietly.
Maud Avery?
Asked Bean, putting his pint down and staring at me with a mixture of disbelief and humour.
Like to the lark, Maud Avery.
That's the one, I said.
One of the best writers Ireland has ever produced,
he said, slapping his hand down on the table a few times.
Do you know, I think I remember you now. You were at the funeral. I was there myself.
Of course I was at the funeral, I said. She was my adoptive mother.
She'll find her peace with the Lord, said Mary Margaret, in an evangelical tone that made me turn to her with a contemptuous expression on my face.
I can see you still in the front row in a little dark suit,
said Bean.
Sit right there next to your father.
His adoptive father, said Julian.
Shut up, Julian,
I said, a rare moment of displeasure from me to him.
You gave one of the readings.
I did, I said.
And sung a song.
No, that wasn't me.
It was a beautiful tune. You had us all in tears.
Again, not me. I can't sing.
Yeats said it was like listening to a choir of angels. O'Casey said it was the first time he cried in his entire life.
I didn't sing anything,
I insisted.
Are you aware of the esteem in which we all held your mother?
I didn't know her very well, I said, wishing that Julian hadn't brought this topic up.
How could you not know her well? Asked Bean. If he was your mother.
My adoptive mother, I insisted for the umpteenth time.
When did she adopt you?
When I was 3 days old.
3 years old?
3 days old.
3 days old? For then she was your real mother, for all intents and purposes.
We weren't close, I said.
Have you read her books?
No, I said.
None of them?
None of them.
I told him,
said Julian, perhaps feeling a little excluded from the conversation.
Not even Light to the Lark.
Why do people keep telling me to read that? No, not even Light to the Lark.
Right so, said Bean. Well, you should if you have even a small interest in Irish literature.
That's exactly what I have, I said.
Christ, he said, looking from Julian to me and back again. Your father is Max Woodbeard. Your mother is Maud Avery. What about you girls? How are your parents? The Pope? Al McCogan? Dirtis Day?
I'm going downstairs to the Jacks, I said, standing up and looking around the table. I need a piss.
We don't need to know, said Mary Margaret. Fuck you, I said, before giggling uncontrollably.
Do you know something? Said Bean, smiling at her sweetly. If you want to loosen yourself up a little, maybe you should go down there with him. Let me find a way to sort you out. You've got to lose it sometime, Missy, and so does he. This paired on the other hand, he added, nodding towards Julie and Bridget. They're well into it already, I'd say. So he is only short of dragging her under the table and sticking it to her right here.
I stepped over the back of the chairs before I could hear her response, and stumbled downstairs, urinating long and furiously against the back wall, and wishing that we had never come to the palace bar to begin with. How long was Bean going to sit with us? And why hadn't Julian told me that he planned a foursome for the evening? Was he afraid that, had I known, I would never have come? The fact was, I would have anyway. It was easier to sit in front of him, watching him get up to all sorts, than it was to be left alone in our room at Belvedere College, imagining it. When I came back upstairs, Bean was back in his barstool, and Bridget was rubbing Mary Magdalene's arm while she dabbed at her eye with a handkerchief.
"It's just such a vulgar question," she was saying. "What kind of a woman would do such a thing?"
"Don't upset yourself, Mary Margaret," said Bridget. "It's an American thing, that's all. He probably heard about it over there."
"Cyril, you're around, I think,"
said Julian, nodding in the direction of the girls and rolling his eyes.
"We're not going to stay here all night, are we?" asked Bridget.
"I'm not staying another minute," said Mary Margaret. "To be spoken to like that in public by a man such as him. My private parts are my own business and no one else's."
She swung around and, showing a bit of life the first time since she'd arrived, roared over towards the barstool.
"They should send you back to Boston and you're to rot there, you filthy article."
Bean's shoulders heaved with laughter, and he raised his pint in salute, while the rest of the men hooted and shouted lines like, "That's you told now, Brandon," and "Fair fucks to the little ditch." And Mary Margaret looked like she might burst out crying again, or simply go on a rampage and tear the palace bar apart brick by brick.
"Dublin's a big place," said Julian,
trying to hold the evening together.
"We could go sit in the grass at Trinity College and watch all the queers play cricket."
"Let's do that,"
said Bridget.
"It's a nice evening out after all, and they always look so handsome in their all whites."
"If the grass gets too cold, you can rely on me to keep you warm," he said, and she giggled again as we all stood up.
Finishing our drinks and making our way towards the door, I pushed ahead, trying to get closer to Julian, anxious to ask him whether we might be able to go somewhere, just the two of us. But as I did so, I brushed Mary Margaret's arm by mistake.
"Do you mind?" she snapped. "Manners cost nothing."
"Sorry," I said, frightened of looking at her in case she turned me to stone. We stood on the street, Mary Margaret and myself weighed down with our miserable faces, while Julian and Bridget practically used each other as scaffolding.
"What was that you said, Cyril?"
asked Julian, looking over at me, while Bridget buried herself deep in his neck, and inexplicably, as far as I could see, appeared to be biting him like some sort of drunken vampire.
"I said nothing." "Oh, right. I thought you said you were going to walk Mary Margaret to her bus stop and then take the bus back to school yourself and you'd see me tomorrow."
"No," I said, shaking my head in bewilderment. I didn't even open my mouth.
"I think you're trying to lead me into temptation," said Bridget,
winking at him,
and she pressed even closer to his body as I turned away and caught sight of a car streaking its way around the corner of Dame Street at an unnatural speed before turning in our direction, racing along Westmoreland Street and pulling in next to us with a screech of its brakes as the back doors were flung open.
"What the hell?"
asked Julian, as two men in balaclavas leaped from the back seat, grabbed him roughly, and dragged him to the rear of the car, where a third man had already opened the boot. Before anyone could protest, they pushed him inside, slammed it shut, and jumped back into the car before speeding off again. The whole thing had taken no more than half a minute, and as the car raced down a Connell Street out of sight, all I could do was stand there and stare at it as it disappeared into the distance, uncertain what madness had just taken place before my eyes. It was only quickness of thought on my part that made me grab Mary Margaret as she bent over and started vomiting on the pavement, half a dozen snowballs making the way back into the world. But then she dragged me to the ground on top of her, where we lay in a suspicious position until an old woman passing by hit me with her umbrella, saying that we weren't animals, and if we didn't stop what we were doing that moment, she'd call the Gardaí and have us both locked up for public indecency.
Ransom.
While the number of spelling and punctuation errors in the ransom notes suggested a degree of illiteracy on the part of Julian's kidnappers, it was to their credit that it was unfailingly polite. "Hello. We have the boy, and we know his daddy's a rich man and a traitor to the cause of a united Ireland, so we want £100,000, or we'll put a bullet in his head. Await further instructions. Thank you and best wishes." Within hours, every news report in the country was leading with the kidnap, and a terrible photograph of Julian, looking angelic in his school uniform, was circulating throughout the media. Upon the instructions of the Garda Commissioner, little information was given out, other than to confirm the identity of the 15-year-old boy, to admit that he was the son of one of Ireland's most prominent solicitors, and to confirm that he had been abducted in broad daylight in the middle of the city centre. At a hastily arranged press conference, the Commissioner avoided any questions referring to the Irish Republican Army or the border campaign, and simply said that no member of the Gardaí would rest until the boy was found, although, as it was quite late in the day already, they wouldn't start the search in earnest until the following morning at 9 o'clock. Bridget, Mary Margaret and I were brought to Pierce Street Garda Station, and when I asked why they were left sitting in the corridor while I was brought into a private room, I was told that this was to ensure that I didn't molest either of them on Garda premises. I'm not sure what it was about my appearance that made me seem like a pubescent rapist, but for some peculiar reason, I took this as a compliment. They gave me a cup of warm tea, heavily sweetened, and half a packet of Marietta biscuits, and only as my trembling began to diminish did I realize that I'd been shaking ever since the car had pulled away from Westmoreland Street with Julian in the boot. I was left alone for the best part of an hour, and when the door finally opened, to my astonishment, my adoptive father marched in. "Charles," I said, standing up and offering him my hand, which was his preferred form of greeting. I had tried to hug him only once, at Maud's funeral, and he had recoiled from me as if I had leprosy. It had been several months since I had seen him, and his complexion was darker than before, as if he had just come back from a foreign holiday. Also, his hair, which had been turning a rather dignified shade of grey, had undergone a volte-face, for it was entirely black again. "What are you doing here?"
"I'm not quite sure," he said, looking around the room with the curiosity of someone who had never been in a police cell before, despite the fact that he had spent a couple of years brooding over his fraudulent tax activities in the Joy. "I was in the bank when the Gardaí arrived, and I must admit, when they walked into my office, I got a bit of a fright. I thought I was in trouble again, but no, it was just to tell me that you were being held here, and they needed a parent or guardian to be present while they questioned you, and I suppose I'm the closest thing to either one of those. How are you, anyway, Cyril?"
"Not very good," I told him. "My best friend got kidnapped by the IRA a few hours ago and bundled away to God knows where. I don't even know if he's alive or dead."
"That's desperate," he said, shaking his head. "And did you hear that Sean Lamass is the new Taoiseach?
What do you make of him, anyway? I don't like the amount of oil he puts in his hair. It gives him an air of malevolence.
He turned around as the door opened, and an older guard stepped inside, carrying a folder and a cup of tea, and introduced himself as Sergeant Kinane.
"You're the boy's father?"
he asked Charles as we all sat down. "His adoptive father," he replied. "Cyril isn't a real Avery, as you can probably tell just by looking at him. My wife and I took him into our home when he was just a baby in an act of Christian charity."
"And is your wife on her way into us too?"
"I'd be shocked if she was," he said.
"Maud died a few years ago. Cancer. She beat it when it was in the ear canal, but once it spread to her throat and tongue, that was it. Curtains."
"I'm very sorry," said the sergeant.
But Charles waved his sympathy away.
"Don't be, don't be," he said. "Time has been a great healer. And it's not as if I didn't have other options. Now tell me, Sergeant, what's going on here exactly? I heard a little bit on the radio on the way in, but I'm mostly in the dark."
"It seems that your son..."
"Adoptive son."
"It seems that Cyril here and his friend Julian left the grounds of Belvedere College earlier today in contravention of school rules for a rendezvous with two older girls in the Palace Bar, Westmoreland Street."
"Are those the two girls I saw sitting out there in the corridor? One of them was in floods of tears, and the other looked bored out of her tits."
"Yes, that was them," said Sergeant Kinane, as I looked away in embarrassment.
"Which was yours, Cyril?" he asked, turning to me. "Tears or tits?"
I bit my lip, unsure how to answer. Strictly speaking, neither of them was mine, but if we had to be paired in any specific way, there could only be one accurate answer.
"Tears,"
I said.
He made a
sound,
and his face registered his disappointment.
"Do you know,"
he said, turning to the sergeant again, "if I'd had to put money on it, I would have guessed that he'd say tears. But I really hoped for his own sake that he would have said tits. Sometimes I wonder where I went wrong. It's not as if I brought him up to respect women."
"Mr. Avery,"
said the sergeant, doing well to keep his composure,
"we have to ask your son, your Cyril, a few questions. Can you just remain quiet while we get through this?"
of course," he said. "Terrible business all the same. Who's this Julian fellow anyway? The one who got kidnapped?"
"My roommate," I told him. "Julian Woodbead."
He shot forward in his seat like a bullet. "Not Max Woodbead's young lad?"
"That's right, sir,"
said the sergeant.
"Ha!"
he cried, bursting into an unexpected round of applause.
"Funny story, Sergeant. So this fellow, Max Woodbead, was my solicitor a few years back. He wasn't as well known then as he is now, of course. He made his name off me, I might say. There was a time when we were the best of friends, but I hold my hands up and admit that I made a few wrong decisions on the marital front, and let's just say that I laid the old garden hose down on someone else's front lawn. Max's front lawn, to be precise. And when he found out, he gave me a right seeing to."
Charles slammed his fist down on the table, making us both jump and causing the sergeant's tea to spill over the side of his cup. "And do you know something? I never held it against him. Not for a moment. He was quite within his rights. But then, after I went to prison, he bought my house at a knock-down price and threw my wife and adoptive son out on the street. And Maud, not a well woman. That was a terrible thing to do, and I'll never forgive him for it. But having said that, it's an awful thing to lose a son. The parents should never have to bury a child. I had a daughter once, but she only lived a few days, and..."
"Mr. Avery, please,"
insisted the sergeant, rubbing his temples as if he had a headache coming on.
"No one has lost anyone yet."
"Well, misplace the son, then, if you prefer."
"There's a quote coming back to me. Oscar Wilde, I think. Do you know it?"
"If you could just remain silent, sir, while I talk to Cyril."
Charles looked baffled, as if he couldn't quite understand what the problem was.
"But, he's sitting right here," he said, pointing at me. "Ask him anything you like. I'm not stopping you."
Thank you, said Sergeant Kinane. Now, Cyril, you're not in any trouble, but I need you to be honest with me, all right?
Yes, sir, I said, anxious to please. But can I just ask you, do you think Julian is dead?
No, I don't, he said.
It's early days, and we haven't even received details of where the kidnappers want the money to be sent. They'll hold on to him for a bit yet. He's their collateral, you see. There's no reason for them to harm him.
I exhaled in relief. The idea of Julian being murdered made me dizzy with terror. I wasn't sure that I'd be able to survive such an outcome.
Now, Cyril, tell me why you went into town this afternoon.
It was Julian's idea, I said. I thought we were going in to look at the shops or maybe go to the pictures, but really he'd arranged to meet Bridget and wanted me with him because she was bringing another girl to make up a foursome. I would have been happy to have gone to Stephen's Green to feed the ducks.
Oh, for God's sake, said Charles, rolling his eyes.
The sergeant ignored him as he wrote all this down.
And how did he know Miss Simpson?
He asked me.
Who's Miss Simpson?
Bridget.
Oh.
Where did they meet?
In the tea room at Leinster House, I said. We went there on a school trip a couple of weeks ago.
And they hit it off, did they?
I shrugged. I wasn't sure how to answer this.
Did this Bridget creature ever come to your school?
He asked.
Did she stay with Julian in your room at all?
She did not, I said, blushing. I didn't even know that Julian had stayed in touch with her. They must have been writing to each other, but he never said a word about it to me.
I'll know about that soon enough, said Sergeant Kinane. I have an officer over there now doing a search. He should be back any time now.
I opened my eyes wide in panic and felt my stomach drop. A search of what? I asked.
Of your room. In case there's anything there that might help us find Julian.
Will you just be searching his side of the room? I asked. No, he said, frowning.
Sure, we don't know which side is his, do we? And things can get mixed up anyway. Sorry, Cyril, but we'll be looking through your things, too. You've nothing to hide, have you?
I glanced around for a bin. There was a possibility that I might be sick.
Are you all right?
He asked me.
You're going a bit pale.
I'm Grant, I said, my voice catching my throat. I'm just worried about him, that's all. He's my best friend.
Oh, Jesus, Cyril,
said Charles, looking a bit disgusted.
Would you stop talking like that? It makes you sound like a right Nancy boy.
Have you ever seen Julian associating with strangers?
The sergeant asked me, ignoring my adoptive father's latest interruption. No, I said.
Any strange men on the school grounds at all?
Only the priests.
You mustn't lie to me, Cyril, he said, pointing a finger at me. Because I'll know if you're lying.
If that's true, then you must know that I'm not, I said. I haven't seen anyone.
All right. The thing is, we've reason to believe that the men who seized Julian have been planning this for some time. His father received death threats from the IRA after the piece he wrote in the Sunday Press a couple of months ago, saying that the supreme musical composition of all time is God Save the Queen.
I have something to admit, said Charles, leaning forward, a serious expression on his face now.
What's that, Mr. Avery?
Asked Sergeant Kinane, turning to him doubtfully.
It's not something I've ever told anyone before, but in this room, which is a sort of confessional, I suppose, I feel I can say it, particularly since I'm among friends. The thing is, I think the Queen is a very attractive woman. I mean, she's 33 now, I think, and that's about 5 years older than I usually go for, but I would make an exception in her case. There's something quite frisky about her, don't you think? I'd say she takes a bit of warming up, but once you've loosened the corsets...
Mr. Avery,
said the sergeant,
this is a serious business. Could I ask you to stop talking, please?
Oh, be my guest, said Charles, sitting back again and folding his arms. Cyril, answer the man before he has us all locked up.
But he hasn't asked me anything, I protested.
I don't care. Answer him. I turned to the sergeant with a bewildered look on my face.
Cyril, has anyone ever approached you to ask you where you and Julian might be discovered at any particular time?
No, Sergeant, I said.
And who would have known that you were going to the Palace Bar today?
I didn't even know myself until we got there.
But Julian knew.
Yes, he had it planned. Maybe he tipped off the IRA, suggested Charles.
Why would he do that?
Asked Sergeant Kinane, staring at him as if he were a complete moron. You're right. Makes no sense. Move on.
And Miss Simpson, Bridget, continued the sergeant. She must have known too.
I presume so.
What about her friend, Miss Muffet?
Miss Muffet? I said, staring at him. Mary Margaret's surname is Muffet?
Yes.
I tried not to laugh. It didn't seem like her standard at all.
I don't know what she knew or didn't know,
I said.
There was a tap on the door. A young guard had looked inside, and the sergeant excused himself, leaving Charles and I alone together.
So,
he said, breaking the silence after a minute or two.
How have you been, anyway?
Grant, I said.
And school is going well? Yes.
Work is hell. I'm in there all day and half the night.
Did I tell you that I'm getting married again?
No, I said, surprised.
When? Next week, actually. To a very nice girl named Angela Manningtree.
A chest out to here and legs that go all the way down to the floor. 26 years old. Works in the civil service, Department of Education. Or does, until the wedding, anyway. Quite intelligent, too, which, actually, I rather like in a woman.
You must meet her sometime. Will I be invited to the wedding? I asked. Oh, no, he said, shaking his head. It will be quite a small affair, just friends and family. But I'll make sure to introduce you to her the next time you're on school holidays. I'm not quite sure what Angela's actual relationship to you would be. She won't be your stepmother or your adoptive stepmother. It's a mystery. I might consult someone in the legal profession for the actual term.
Max is the best lawyer I know, but I suppose now wouldn't be the right time.
You have a cut above your eye, by the way. Were you aware of that?
I was, yes.
Did one of the kidnappers do that to you as you battled valiantly to save your friend from their clutches?
No, I said. An old woman hit me with her umbrella.
Of course she did.
The door opened again, and Sergeant Kinane came back in, flicking through some pages that he held in his hand.
Cyril, he said. Did Julian have a paramour apart from this Bridget girl?
A what? I asked.
A girlfriend.
No, I said. Not that I know of, anyway.
The thing is, we've discovered a number of letters in your room addressed to Julian. They're quite, suggestive in their way. Erotic, you know. Dirty stuff. About the way this girl feels about him and the things she wants to do to him. But the problem is, they're unsigned.
I stared at the table and tried to think of anything that would stop my face from bursting into flames.
I don't know anything about them, I said.
I'll tell you what, he said. If Mrs. Kinane had half the imagination that this girl has, I'd be taking early retirement.
Both he and Charles burst out laughing at this, and I looked down at my shoes, praying that the interview would come to an end soon.
Anyway, this all looks harmless enough, he said. It probably has nothing to do with the kidnapping. Still, we have to follow up every lead.
He turned the pages and read some more, his lips moving as his eyes flickered across the words, and finally he frowned when he reached something he didn't understand.
What does that mean, do you think?
He asked, showing the letter to Charles and pointing something out, and my adoptive father whispered something in his ear.
Christ alive, said the sergeant, shaking his head in disbelief. I never heard of such a thing.
A type of woman would do something like that.
The very best type, said Charles.
Mrs. Kinane certainly wouldn't, but then she's from Roscommon. Well, whoever this lassie is, she wants to do it to Julian Woodbead.
Ah, to be young again, said Charles with a sigh.
Can I go now? I asked.
You can,